The Pension Commission will come to order on March 5th. I'm going to rearrange the agenda a little bit in the sense that we have some visitors that aren't here every time, and so we're going to put them at the top of the agenda rather than at the end of the agenda. But I would like to tell you that our first guest today is Mansco Perry, who has been given the Lifetime Achievement Award for his service in finance. And it was awarded to him at the 9th Annual CIO Innovation Awards Dinner. And this is a national recognition of his greatness. And we so appreciate that we are have a great among us. And so he is going to tell us about the condition of the State Board of Investment. And he is our director and our great. Mr. Perry, welcome. Congratulations.
How do you use these things?
And he has just flown in from somewhere, I understand.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members. Mansco Perry, the Executive Director and Chief Investment Officer for the State Board of Investment. My greatness is greatly exaggerated, but true. I thought I'd start off with my customary just overview of who and what the State Board of Investment is. So the State Board of Investment's a creature of Article 11 of the Constitution, and consists of the governor, the Secretary of State, the Attorney General, and the State Auditor. We're assisted by a 17-member investment advisory council. We have the three pension fund directors or ex officio members, as is the Commissioner of Management and Budget. The governor appoints two active members and one retiree member. And we have 10 members of the public who have knowledge in investment finance that fill out and are very helpful to myself and the board. I have a staff of about 22, 23 people, half of which are the investment staff, and the rest are accounting and support staff. As of the end of the fiscal year, we were responsible in total for about $96 billion. As of the end of the calendar year, it was down to 90. And as of last Friday, we were back up approximately 94 to 95 billion in total, most of which are the pension assets. We're back to about 68 billion for the pension assets as of last. I don't know how the market did today. I presume it was flat. Our board meets meets once a quarter to go over what we've done and what we tried to get approved. We are responsible for what I've kind of redefined as four pots of money. The combined pension funds are the biggest and the one that everyone likes to talk about. We also are responsible for what I've named the participant-directed investment program, which consists of the several defined contribution programs, deferred comp, the college savings program, the ABLE and the ABLE program. That's about $14 or $15 billion enterprise. We also manage the state cash, which includes the general fund. It's about $12 billion. And we manage non-retirement funds, which basically are the vehicles for the permanent school fund, the environmental trust fund, and the IRRRB uses us amongst several other agencies. So I think what Susan said, that you'd like a review of what returns were for the past year. So last year, we were fortunate enough for the fiscal year. We had a return of 10.3% versus our benchmark, about 9.7. And so over the past 30 years, that has been about a 9.1% return. The fourth quarter wasn't so good. We were down about 7.7, but as I mentioned before, we've had a nice rebound in the last 2 months. Don't have the exact figures. But fiscal year to date, we're at about 3.5, 4% with about 4 months to go. I'm willing to answer any questions anyone has.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Perry, is Lieutenant Governor not on the investment board? Is that the one executive officer that is not?
Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, that's the one. She's a member of the executive council. Then the way our meetings run, there's the executive council. She leads. Then we have the State Board of Investment. The Secretary of State leads, and it's the land exchange.
And the, sorry, the Secretary of State leaves, and what?
Then we have the land exchange.
Land exchange, okay.
Mr. Perry, the permanent school fund, is that increasing now that the legislature has addressed that issue in the last few years? Are we making more money? Are we increasing because we have more capital to put in?
Let's see, if Madam Chair, that's been pretty stable. We only have stocks and bonds in that program, that's just been pretty stable with the market. We aren't allowed to invest in some of the more interesting vehicles that we do for the pension fund.
And so, thank you.
Me again.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, Mr. Perry, when you mentioned, I was trying to write fast, your four pots, your third pot, I thought you said was state cash. Does that include, like, the reserve fund and the cash flow account?
Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, that includes all the money that Myron Franz gives us, which basically I think it would include the cash reserve fund, and essentially the bulk of the money is that we essentially act as kind of the with MNB as the bank checking account for all state agencies.
Senator Franz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, since you mentioned it, can you tell us a little more about the interesting investments?
Okay. Madam Chair, Senator Franz, maybe I'll give you a sense of the asset allocation for the pension plan. Pension plan, basically we have stocks, which account for about 60% of the program, and that's both domestic and international stocks. Bonds, we split that between core bonds and treasuries, little cash, and the interesting investments, as I call them, those, that's our private market vehicles. We invest in private equity, we invest in real estate, we invest in resources, private resources, primarily energy, and we have private credit and distressed and opportunistic vehicles. But those are all of a private nature and limited partnerships. And that program began about 1980.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Perry, you mentioned you're about 10.3% return right now? Is that, and your benchmark is 9.7? Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, no, that was the fiscal year.
The fiscal year.
That was the fiscal year number. For the calendar year, unfortunately, we weren't as robust. For calendar year 18, we had a return of negative 2.9 versus a benchmark of negative 0.3. But our calendar year to date, which is 2 months, we're about 7%. But for the fiscal year to date, that equates to about 3.5% or so.
And Madam Chair?
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Perry, what are you projecting in the next 10 months? 12 months.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, other members, we're not in the forecasting business.
Yeah.
We leave that to Mr. Franz and others. We go through an asset allocation about every 5 years, and our current asset allocation is presumed to make somewhere in the order of the 7.5%. And as I advised the commission last year, we said it and I forget it. But we have had some very good long-term returns. And, you know, the primary reason for that is the asset mix that we have, which right now we've got about 15 or 16% in private market vehicles, which over the last 30 years we've earned about 12.5%.
We're looking forward to more, Mr. Perry. Thank you so much. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Perry, you mentioned there's kind of like four pods of money. Are they commingled for management, or do you manage each one kind of individually relative to the characteristics of the pod, or whatever you call the distinct little pools?
Madam Chair, Representative Vogel, are you talking about for the pension plans or the four programs that we manage money for?
Madam Chair, Mr. Perry, the programs themselves. In other words, you've got a pool of about $90 million of some in pensions and so forth. And just curious, is it all managed the same, or do you look at this pool as one way to manage because of the nature of that pool and this one and that so forth? Okay. Or are they just commingled when they're managed? Okay.
Madam Chair, Madam Chair, Representative Vogel. So each of the four programs have distinct investment vehicles. So for the combined funds, all the money is managed by external managers. My staff does due diligence. The IC will vet what we've done, and those are. Basically stocks, bonds, the private market vehicles that I spoke of, and cash to make sure that we are able to meet payroll every 2 weeks. Then in the participant directed investments, the vast bulk of those are mutual funds. We do manage some of the defined contribution plans. They piggyback on the portfolios on the defined benefit plans. July 1, they'll be all migrating to mutual funds. So individuals will be able to see what they're doing day to day, and they've got complete control over that. You know, those are just primarily stock and bond mutual funds. There's a target date fund which has age appropriate or lifespan appropriate mix of funds that individuals can get into. The state cash is managed internally, and that's all short-term cash. No very little risk taken with that, but it's primarily short-term cash. That's also the program that has the CD program that you're aware of, where we buy CDs of Minnesota community banks. We're pretty careful about that. We'll only buy up to something a little less than the FDIC insurance rate. And that program's been in existence well over 30 years. And lastly, the non-retirement funds, those are managed externally by a fixed income manager for the bond program and a equity manager for the equity program, except for one of the assigned risk program. While it uses the equity program in the non-retirement space, we do have an external manager who manages the bond portion of the assigned risk plan.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Herr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a couple of quick questions. So what are the who are the external managers that you use, or what firms are they with? And then what do we pay them in fees for those for them to manage our funds?
Mr. Perry.
Chairman Murphy, Representative Herr, you're all invited to go to our website, and we have under our employ well in excess of 100 managers.
Okay.
We don't pay rack rate. Okay. I've been pretty successful in getting on the stock and bond side, fees pretty low. We've gone on the equity side. We manage quite a bit of funds passively.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a marginal rate for new dollars in that. That's approaching less than a quarter of a basis point, which is almost free.
Thank you. Just one quick
follow-up. One quick follow-up. Representative Herr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, I'm a numbers person. I like to dig into the numbers. I'm sure there's probably somewhere I can go in to look for something that maybe is laid out more like an annual report that shows me like performance over time. Okay, perfect. Thank you.
And that can be found on, we can get you a copy, but it's available on our website in PDF form.
Any other questions? You may conclude, and thank you so much for coming, and thank you so much for agreeing to testify tonight.
Thank you.
Yeah. Commissioner Franz. Thank you for agreeing to come tonight.
I'm good. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm glad to be here. It's a pleasure to be here. I have with me Paul Moore from MMB to answer the tough questions that you might have. But thank you for the opportunity to be here. I just I like the question that you had about the Senator Rosen about the likely returns coming up. And I think since Mansco got this recognition, he's so talented that surely he can promise us some really good returns, I would think, that would go with that.
Too bad he's so shy about
he's
it.
He's so shy, I know. He does great work, and I'm really honored to work with Mansco, with the State Board of Investment. And as you know, he manages all of our money very, very carefully and does a really excellent job. So I'm really pleased to be able to work with him. And I'm pleased to be before the Pension Commission again. It's great to be here and see a lot. I was going to say old friends, but I'm old. You're not. I have friends who I've been friends with for a long time. So it's really good to see you all again and to be here. I appreciate the work you put in on this committee or this commission, because it's a lot of work and it takes a lot of time. And we've done a lot of great work. What I'd like to do tonight, Madam Chair, is you asked for a couple of different areas for me to comment on. And one, I'd like to comment on a little bit about what I've learned from the rating agencies this last year or so in the process of going through the pension reform that we've gone through here. So one of the things that, as you know, when we passed the Pension Reform Act this last year, We were hoping that we would see some positive response to that, and I want to talk a little bit about what the rating agencies really said. As we went through that reform, we all know that it was a shared sacrifice model where everyone participated. It really led to a path for full funding, and it also protected the security of Minnesota's public workers and retirees for years to come. This bill, as we all know, had the unanimous support of the legislature, and I don't know that I've ever said that before. Mm-hmm. The governor, the pension systems, the stakeholder groups, it really has served as a national model. We've been, a lot of people around the country have talked about how impressed they were with what we were able to do. And I really want to commend the commission staff and Chair Rosen at the time for being able to make this a success story. But it did, and it did not go unnoticed by the credit rating agency. So when we presented our bonding proposal or our bonds to sell last summer, we had the opportunity to meet with the rating agencies and let them know about what it was that we had done. And they were really they were impressed in 2018 after we made the presentation to the rating agencies. We were able to retain our AAA rating from Fitch, and Standard & Poor's upgraded us to AAA for the first time since 2010. In their rating report, Standard & Poor's explicitly listed the pension bill as a key driver of the upgrade. They noted that the reforms will significantly reduce Minnesota's already moderate per capita unfunded liabilities. S&P even remarked on the unanimous vote for the bill, stating that this strong bipartisan support, in combination with our state's record of being really smart about reforms when we need to do it, demonstrated a commitment to actively managing our pension liabilities, which fits their model of what a AAA state does. A AAA state, in the view of the credit rating agencies, continues to make sure that their finances are managed carefully, that the needs of maintaining our pension funds and maintaining surpluses in our budgets are addressed every year, regardless of the shifting powers that occur. They believe that with divided government or without divided government, AAA states make sure that they take care of the needs of the state. Now, these changes were a major step in the direction of getting our AAA rating restated, but the rating agencies continue to apply more scrutiny. So like a lot of good things, we're not done, and as you know, in the pension commission, we're never done managing and monitoring what we're doing. And the people who come to this pension commission every night, I'm always impressed with their concern and their watchful eye, but we need to know that we have more work to do in the future. One of the issues that the credit rating agencies raised was our assumed rate of return on investments. The pension bill lowered the rate to 7.5%, as you recall, down from 8 or 8.5%, depending upon the plan. Now, this change downward was viewed positively by the credit rating agencies because it made us no longer an outlier to other states. But a 7.5% investment return, unless Mansco starts promising that on a regular basis, assumes and puts Minnesota on the high end of the spectrum when compared to other states. Then the National Association of State Retirement Administrators, the median investment return assumption among pension funds now stands at 7.25%. So rating agencies are naturally skeptical that pension plans will be able to return the same investment earnings they have in the past based on current market conditions. And they believe plans should adopt more conservative investment return assumptions to mitigate unfunding risk in the future. So that is something that we can look forward to. If a 7.5% investment return did not materialize, the state, as you know, would need to adjust our benefits or increase contributions to ensure that our pension funds remain on a path to full funding. And this brings me to the second point that the credit rating agencies made. Because actual experience, as we know, is going to differ from what our actuarial assumptions are, every year plan actuaries recalculate the amount of contributions needed to maintain the trajectory toward full funding within the amortization period. This is known as the annual required contribution, or ARC. Many public pension plans automatically fund their ARC by adjusting contribution rates year to year. Minnesota, on the other hand, does not have a mechanism to automatically pay the ARC. Instead, our employee and employer contribution rates are set in statute. Right now, our pension plans are on track to fully fund their arcs because of the 2018 pension bill. But if Minnesota's plans begin to fall behind and unfunded liabilities grow as they did before the pension bill, fixing it will require legislative action. The rating agencies consider automatic funding of the ARC as a best practice. And if pension plans do not have the policies or legal flexibility to do this, they are going to be increasingly viewed as a credit risk in the future. So something else for us to consider as we go forward. I want to talk a little bit about the Minneapolis Employees Retirement Fund. But before I do that, I just thought I might stop, see if there are any questions about the rating agencies and what I just reported on. All right. Well, let me jump into the Minneapolis Employees Retirement Fund, or MERF. The governor, as you know, has proposed restoring the funding for this in this 2021 biennial budget recommendations. MERF used to provide the retirement benefits for Minneapolis public employees. In 2010, the administration of MERF was transferred to PARA, and in 2015, the fund was officially merged into the PARA general plan. To pay down the unfunded liabilities of MERF, there have been longstanding supplemental contributions to the fund paid by both the state and Minneapolis local governments. In the year prior to the merger, these contributions totaled $55 million. $24 million was paid by the state and $31 million was paid by the local governments. After the merger in 2015, PARA determined that it needed $37 million a year to pay off the unfunded liabilities, an $18 million reduction just from that year before. 2015 legislation allocated these savings to the state for 2 years, reducing the state contributions from $24 million down to $6 million. And that was for 2016 and 2017. However, state contributions were also set to increase to $16 million beginning in fiscal year 2018, and local government contribution would then be decreased from $31 million to $21 million. However, 2017 legislation changed this allocation. The state government omnibus bill lowered the state contribution back down to $6 million annually and increased the local government contributions back to $31 million. All beginning in fiscal year 20. If this increase goes into effect next year, it will result in $10 million in additional costs for local governments, including over $5 million a year for the city of Minneapolis, over $2 million a year for the Minneapolis School District, and over $1 million a year for the Minneapolis Park Board. These cost increases would hit local governments at exactly a very difficult time when they're already facing cost pressures around government, local government aid. It also means that they would likely need to increase property taxes to fill that budget hole, affecting homeowners and small business owners. Keeping in line with this original commitment to community investment and prosperity, Governor Walz recommends reinstating the 2015 agreement by increasing contributions to MERF by $10 million each year. His proposal prevents a $10 million annual cost increase from hitting local governments, ensuring that these payments do not displace critical local services or result in property tax increases. The governor firmly believes that the state reached an agreement with local governments during the 2015 merger, and the state has an obligation to keep their end of the bargain. And with that, Madam Chair, I'm happy to take questions.
Seems like we understand what you were saying.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate
Thank
that.
You. Thank you. Senator Pappas.
Commissioner, would you just say one more time, right now the state's paying $6 million and Minneapolis $31 million, and the proposal that was in the 2015 merger agreement was what?
So, right now, in 2018 and 2019, mm-hmm. The state of Minnesota is paying $16 million a year
right.
in fiscal 18 and fiscal 19.
Okay.
The 2017 allocation would drop that by $10 million a year to $6 million by the state for 20 and 21 going forward.
Okay.
Instead of the $16 million, which would cause the increase of $10 million to the city of Minneapolis and other entities.
So the Madam Chair, proposal then is to keep the state at $16 million, which would mean Minneapolis would the Minneapolis school governments would pay 24?
$21 million.
Okay. And from 31.
And the governor's budget has that.
So it's 10 million.
Proposed budget 16, has 16, that 16, in.
Yes, it does.
His recommendations are to pay it.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner France, what happens if that's not taken care of this year? What is the consequences?
Madam Chair, Senator, so what would happen is the $10 million would not be put in by the state in 20 and 21, and so that would increase the contribution by Minneapolis and the city of Minneapolis, the school district, and the Minneapolis Park Board by $10 million a year going forward. So it would increase their contribution another $10 million a year going forward.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And switching gears a little bit back to our bond rating, you mentioned S&P. I'm sorry, did I miss the other bond ratings?
Madam Chair, Senator, good question. Moody's has not quite seen the light yet, but I do believe that they were very close to giving us a AAA, but, you know, it's up to them. And we think there's a good chance that if we continue our fine ways, we'll get the third AAA one of these days, too.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner France, what was our reasoning? Was it the assumed rate of return?
Madam Chair, Senator, you know, I think part of it was it was a little bit of thank you, that was really nice pension reform. We would have done it differently. And because we didn't do it the way they would have done it there, it was a little bit we could have done it more in a way they would have thought would be. I think the ARC was part of the concern that they had, the automatic funding of the ARC going forward. And so they just didn't quite see us doing as well as we thought we did.
They weren't as Minnesota nice. Any other questions? Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, just a clarification. How much was, I didn't completely follow this, how much was Minneapolis paying in 2014?
Madam Chair.
Exactly.
Right, let me walk through the sequence. So,
okay. Merger agreement.
So initially, and let me go after the merger. So PARA after 2015 determined it needed $37 million a year to pay off the unfunded liabilities. So at that point, we used some of the savings, and the contributions were $24 million. Reduced the state's contributions from $24 million to $6 million initially. Mm-hmm. So because of the savings that they had, and then in 2016 and 2017, but then the contributions were increased to $16 million for the state in 2018 and 19, and then they were reduced back down to $6 million in 2020 and 2021. So it was initially $6 million for the state for 2 years, then it was $16 million for 2 years, and then it got set back to $6 million in 20 and 21.
Thank
Representative
you,
Vogel.
So the first payments were made in 2015?
Yes, Madam Chair. Yes.
And what was the amount of the payments in 2015?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative, in 2015, there was $24 million was paid by the state and $31 million was paid by the local governments. It was after that that it was determined that we didn't need $55 million. We only needed $37 million. And that's how it got divided up, $21 million and $16 million. $21 million to the city, $16 million to the state, beginning in 18 and 19.
So, I'm sorry, Madam Chair. So in 2016, the payment was how much?
That was, there was some savings, so the payment by the state was only $6 million in those 2 years. 16 and 17, the state was able to receive some of the benefit of the reduction, and that was spread over those 2 years, but then it went back to the $16 million and $21 million split that they had agreed to.
Okay. So one more, Madam Chair. Okay. So then in 16, Minneapolis paid 31 to make up the 37?
Yeah, 31.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, just a little more history. So before the merger, then Minneapolis and the city and the school district, when I say Minneapolis, I mean all of them, they were paying the entire deficiency for MRF?
Madam Chair, Senator, before the deal was set, mm-hmm. yes.
So the deal was that the state had some responsibility because they'd allowed the city to pay less into the fund than was sustainable.
Right. Madam Chair, Senator, yes.
Any further questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Vogel.
I'm just curious, because this kind of, I kind of remember this going on, but I didn't remember all the details. Is anybody here from Minneapolis that could clarify just what was being paid before all of the merger happened?
The judge knows. Mr. Rainier.
Madam Chair, my name is Gene Ranieri. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the City of Minneapolis. Representative Vogel, I need to get that information to you. I know over time there was some state contribution, and we and all our other partners put in money too, but I don't know what the total was prior to when we discovered we had a problem in 2008 and 2009. It was identified that we had a $55 million contribution requirement, and we were putting in around $31 million of it, and the state was putting in 24. Prior to that, I need to do some research and get back to you.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Ranieri. Thank you, Mr. Commissioner France.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We really appreciate your attendance.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Well, as long as we're working, Representative Nelson.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the minutes from May 8th, 2018 for approval.
Okay.
I'll do the other one, but I wouldn't.
Okay. May 8th, minutes are before you. All in favor of adoption as printed, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are adopted. Representative Vogel.
I will move the March 13th, 2018 minutes, Madam Chair.
Okay. March 13th minutes, 2018. Representative Vogel moves adoption as printed. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted.
And Madam Chair, I'd like to move the minutes from February 26, 2019.
Okay. Representative Nelson moves the adoption of the minutes of February 26, 2019, as printed. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. The minutes are ours now. Okay. Going back up, Jill Schertz. Executive Director of St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund. Or are you all presenting together?
I think we are.
Oh, well, Jay Stoffel, Doug Anderson, and Aaron Leonard. A panel. In our packets, we have the legislative update.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Commission members. I'm Doug Anderson, Executive Director for PARA.
So Doug's going to go first, and I'm Aaron Leonard, the Director of MSRS.
Jay Stoffel, Executive Director of Teachers Retirement Association.
Jill Schertz, Executive Director, St. Paul Teachers.
Okay, and I'll start us out, and we're all going to participate in the delivery of the information we have. And first, just want to thank you all for the support last year, for something that puts us in a real nice positive position, and really here to share some good news. And we just appreciate the opportunity to be here today to recap a little bit what happened and the funding status that it puts all the plans in. So on page two is just the agenda for what we'll talk about. We'll recap the pension bill, kind of why it was necessary, a brief summary of the reforms, just some of the impact. We'll give an overview of the plans in general, then each of us will respectively go through our individual plans so you get a sense of where they each stand.
Thank you.
So we'll start with the why, and you know, part of, I think, understanding why changes were needed is can also help to partially address the question of will they be needed again in some way. But you know, some of the main reasons that changes were needed, and this goes back 3 or 4 years, back to 2014, 2015, were some things that happened to all of the plans. So every plan has its own history. But some things that were in common was the effect of the recession, as well as some new forecasted mortality rates from our respective actuaries, and a lowering of the investment return assumption. And since then, we've mostly recovered from the recession. The results of investment returns have been really positive over the last 10 years. But the changes that were a result of the assumption changes are really sort of a more permanent fixture in these plans. So specifically, the change in life expectancy and increasing that added about roughly 5% to the plan liabilities, which means the funding ratios decreased by about 5%. And the change in assumption to go from where most of all the plans were as high as 8.5% about 5 years ago down to 7.5% added about 10% to the liability estimates, dropping the funding ratios by 10%. So between these two assumptions, life expectancies and a more conservative investment assumption, it increased liabilities close to 15% overall, dropping funding ratios over 15% overall. So that led to action being necessary. So with regard to life expectancies, I just want to be able to clarify this a little bit, because a lot of this is about what people believe will happen in the future. So setting good mortality rates and developing life expectancies is a two-step exercise. One is something that our actuaries do by looking at actual experience. It's called an experience study. They do these every 5 years. I think they're in the process right now for the MSRS general plan, the para general plan, and the TRA plan this year to do the fresh five-year look back. And this is primarily a math or statistics exercise. They look at what actually happened and compare that to their prior assumption for mortality rates, and then they make adjustments. So that sets a baseline. And the actuaries can be pretty good at this. For example, in our para general plan, looking at the male retiree experience for that period, they estimated 4,472 deaths would occur. It was actually 4,471. We got that very, very close. One person didn't get the message, apparently. So they're not always that accurate, but this is just where they set the baseline for the future. The more challenging part is the forecast. And I would view this as very much like a weather forecast. It's like we can look outside and see what the thermometer says about what it is today, but when you're setting a forecast about what the temperature will be like in a week or two, you know, that's a challenging thing. So, like I notice when I drive into work every day, I hear about the American model for the forecast and the European model for the forecast. And I think this is kind of similar. It's a model. It's built on a lot of data that went into it. The Society of Actuaries came out with a new study in 2014, and that's the new model that's more universally used. Actuaries have been forecasting future mortality improvements for several decades. Is really this model that was more thorough and comprehensive and also more conservative that was a bit of a game changer in 2014. That's what drove the liability estimates up 5%. And since then, the Society of Actuaries has come back with the annual updates. They've put in more data into the model. They made some adjustments to the model. And now for 4 consecutive years, they've actually backed off some of their optimism. So initially, when they said they believe in the future, females will live 2 years longer and males will live, females would live 2.4 years longer and males would live 2 years longer, they've now have scaled that back, cut it in half. I think, what's important to know is, prospectively, there is no new model on the horizon. The model we have is going to get adjusted annually, and these annual adjustments, the plans have the option to incorporate them annually, so we really are unlikely to see any significant spike one way or the other in the liabilities due to mortality experience. In fact, because I can't resist looking at some of this stuff, the Society of Actuaries had a study this year which is showing that actually some life expectancy measured from birth has actually been reducing each of the last 2 years. There's a lot of reasons for it. They're making improvements in the areas of cancer and heart disease, but in pretty much every other category, diabetes, liver ailments, accidents, suicide, opioid use, all that, everything is getting worse. So we're actually seeing a little bit of a change going forward. So that's the mortality update. So since I brought everyone down, just a reminder, in Minnesota, we do have the second longest life expectancy in the nation, and on a positive note. The investment return assumption, I think you've heard quite a bit about this. The only thing I'll add is that there was really a lot of widespread support to be more conservative. It's closer to the national median, as Commissioner Franz noted. And the 10% drop I noted gives a nice rule of thumb that a 1% change in a discount rate or a 1% change in the investment return assumption affects the funding ratios by about 10%. So it gives you a little bit of a measure that if you were to consider either raising or lowering the investment return assumption in the future, that gives you a little sense of what it does for funding ratios. So all of those collectively is why action was needed. Those are all very significant changes that occurred 4 or 5 years ago, and that's what led to the actions that were needed.
So just a reminder, many of you were here for the 2018 pension legislation and were part of that solution, and we thank you for your support. Just to reflect on that a little bit, one of the modifications that applied to all plans was the reduction in the assumed rate of return to 7.5%. We also eliminated future deferred augmentation for all members. So when an individual leaves public service, there used to be a built-in inflation component until they collected benefits. That's been eliminated for both active and people who are already currently deferred. We increased the cost to retire early. So many of us have an actuarial reduction for our early retirement, and there was a subsidy built into that or a bump, if you don't like the word subsidy, and we've actually made that more expensive or more actuarial equivalent to retire early, so we'll see less early retirement in the future. And then for all plans, we adopted a new 30-year amortization period, and this is nice because now we all have the same end date in which we are expected to be fully funded, so you can really do an apples-to-apples comparison of the plans because we were all at different dates prior to the legislation passing. Going to page 5, there were also different answers for different plans. So many of us had employee and employer contribution increases, and those appropriations were included in the legislation. So for the TRA employee and employer increases, it was added to the E12 formula. And for contributions to the MSRS General Correctional State Patrol Plan, PERA Police and Fire, and St. Paul Teachers, those were included in the appropriations. And many of those are phased in anywhere from a 2-year time frame to a 6-year time frame, depending on the plan and depending on the level of the contribution increase. In addition, for the MSRS Public Safety Plans, there's a supplemental employer contribution increase. Those plans are much smaller, so they were really hit hard by the recession, the 2008-2009 downturn, and some of the life expectancy not just applies to the actual member, but their spouses or survivors that they select. For direct plan appropriations, PERA Police and Fire and St. Paul Teachers actually received a direct appropriation in addition to any employer contribution increases that were included in the bill. go to page 6, many of the plans, actually all of them, had, except for a few, had a reduced COLA. So for the MSRS general plan, we reduced our COLA from 2% fixed to 1% for 5 years and 1.5% thereafter. For MSRS correctional, we went from a 2% to a 1.5% fixed. TRA reduced their COLA from 2% down to 1% for 5 years, and then they ratchet up to 1.5% over the remaining 6 to 10 years. So after 10 years, they'll be back up to 1.5%. St. Paul Teachers actually took a COLA freeze for 2 years, I believe. This is testing my memory. And then they have a 1% COLA. For PERA general and correctional, they modified their COLA structure to be more inflation-based, so 50% of inflation with a 1% floor and a 1.5% cap is for the general plan. The correctional is a little bit different than that. For all plans, we removed the COLA trigger for most plans, I should say, that were included in legislation, all plans. The judge's plan does still have a COLA trigger in their plan. They weren't part of the legislation from the benefit side, but were part of the reduction to the 7.5% and 30-year amortization. And then for all plans except for public safety, beginning in 2024, COLAs will be delayed. So if an individual chooses to retire early, they will not receive a COLA benefit or cost of living adjustment until they reach full retirement age. So that was part of the legislation that hasn't quite yet been phased in. So page 7, to talk a little bit about the impact. We thank you all. It was a bipartisanly supported bill. I've just celebrated 20 years of state service, and I can't say that I've ever seen something like it, so it was really great to be part of that over my career. Hopefully it's not the only highlight, but it was a pretty big highlight. it was supported by a broad coalition of unions, employers, and retirees. The total savings over 30 years is $6.1 billion, and we saw immediate liability reductions on July 1 as of $3.4 billion. So it was both a long-term impact as well as an immediate liability reduction, primarily because of the COLA reductions. And then just a reminder, for every $1 the state contributed to the solution, there were $3 in benefit reforms or employee contributions to help make up the full package. And that combined with the 10.3% return from the State Board of Investment, our aggregate funded ratio for the statewide plans is almost 82% relative to our peers of almost 74%. So when you compare us to other states, we're in a much better position. And then all plans, our projection charts for all of our plans show that we're going to get to 100% funded within the 30 years or less, except for the judge's plan, which is slightly longer than the 30-year period. And then finally, I keep forgetting where I'm supposed to cut off. I'm sorry. The final change is that we, and Commissioner France spoke about the upgrade in the credit rating. So an unexpected blessing that we didn't fully expect, but we're glad that we were part of that and cited in a positive way for this year.
Want to keep going?
Oh, that's yours.
Okay. Madam Chair, we'll pick up on slide 10. And this is just a slide on governance. Each of the systems has a board of trustees, a board of directors, and we are there to administer the plan as it's developed by the legislature. So there's a lot of administrative things that we're responsible for. So collecting the contributions on a regular basis, typically every 2 weeks, we receive contributions from the employers. That's both the employee and the employer contribution amounts. A lot of data collection and data integrity, data security is besides safeguarding the assets, the dollars, it's safeguarding the data. We've got a lot of important information on people, addresses, date of birth, bank account numbers, Social Security numbers. It's a huge priority for all of us, and we spend a lot of time and dollars on protecting the data that we have. Obviously, benefit calculations, members are requesting estimates of retirement benefits 1, 2, 3, 4 years prior to the date they expect to retire, and then actually then making benefit payments. In our case, we spend about $1.8 billion every year in retirement benefits that go out to the retired members, predominantly people who are residing in Minnesota, and those dollars go out and multiply throughout the economy. A lot of member education. We do one-on-one counseling with teachers who want to come into the office, but a lot of group seminars and group meetings for larger groups of folks.
And then all the actuarial and audit functions that we perform every year, where we have lots of audit, a lot of good scrutiny of our operations. We have the legislative audit, who audits our financial statements. And in our case, we use the state auditor to do some additional auditing for, it's called the GASB 67 reporting. It's another level of financial reporting that we're obligated to do. So lots of good scrutiny that we have, and then all the financial reporting on an annual basis that we report. Lots of transparency. Our annual report is over 100 pages long. Lots of good statistical information in there, a lot of data that we can look at, trends over the past years with a kind of a comparison of year-to-year layout of the data. So a lot of good analysis in that kind of reporting. So with that, we'll do individual summaries of our plans.
So page 11 starts the MSRS plans. We administer the general employees plan as our largest plan. It covers state of Minnesota employees, Metropolitan Council, University of Minnesota civil service individuals, and some Minnesota state employees or Minnesota state university system employees. As of June 30th, our market value funded ratio is 90.6%, so quite an improvement from the prior year. We have $13.3 billion in assets and a $1.3 billion unfunded liability. In total, we have about 51,000 active members, and we're paying over 40,000 retirees each month or survivors. The initial average benefit as of last year was $1,729 per month, so that's our initial average benefit. Once the contributions are fully phased in from the 2018 legislation, employees are contributing 6% of pay, and the employer is contributing 6.25%. This is actually a shift. Historically, the employee and employer contributions for this particular plan have been equal. As a result of the 2018 legislation, the employer's paying slightly more, and that's to recognize the increased liabilities that because of the 7.5 assumed rate of return as well as the mortality didn't just affect active folks, it affected retirees already as well. And so the state is contributing a little bit more. Our total required contribution is 11.1%. So that's the amount that we need to collect each month or each year to fund future benefits for active employees. So this is the first time I've been able to say this in a very long time. We have a slight contribution sufficiency on a market value basis of 1.15%. In the past, we've had deficiencies, which means we weren't collecting enough to pay future benefits, which is why we're heading in a downward trajectory. Now, with collecting a sufficiency, we have a little cushion. So if we do see some market volatility or some other changes, perhaps from our experience study this year, we have a little cushion to weather that, which is a great place to be in. For our correctional plan members on page 12, this includes the individuals who both work in the Department of Corrections, working directly with offenders, as well as the security hospitals. So they have to meet a threshold of 75% contact in order to participate in this plan. And this is a public safety plan, and so it does have early retirement. So they can retire early at age 50 or at age 55 with full retirement benefits if they're vested. The funded ratio for this plan is 74.8%. There's $1.1 billion in assets, and we have $375.6 million unfunded. Total, about 4,600 active members and 3,200 retired. The average initial benefit for these individuals is $2,073 per month. It is a slightly higher formula because of the early retirement and its public safety. Once all of the contributions are phased in, the employees will be contributing 9.6%. The employer will be contributing 14.4%. With public safety plans, traditionally the employee has paid 40% of the cost and the employer has paid 60% of the cost of the plan. There is an additional supplemental contribution of 4.45% for this plan. Our total required contribution is 25.3%. And we do have a contribution sufficiency of 3% of pay. Last year, we had a deficiency of almost double digits, so a much, much improved situation for this plan. For the State Patrol plan, this is individuals who are state troopers, conservation officers, BCA officers, and state peace officers. So they have to be licensed peace officers to participate in this program. There's 78.4% funded. $729 million in assets, $200 million in unfunded, 921 active members, and over 1,000 retired. And so this is a plan that is really impacted a lot by those changes in assumptions as well as market volatility. It's a very small program, and because the bulk of the liabilities are on the retiree side, we see a lot more ups and downs in this particular plan. The average initial benefit is almost $4,000 a month. However, these individuals do not receive Social Security benefits. So we'll say that they're not coordinated with Social Security, which means they're not paying contributions into Social Security as a State Patrol member. Our other plans that we administer are coordinated with Social Security, so they're both paying into their pension as well as Social Security, and so that combined benefit is coordinated. Employees contribute 15.4%. The employer contributes 23.1%, and there is a supplemental employer contribution that will be phased in of 7%, and that sounds like a significant percentage. However, the dollars are about $5 to $6 million. So a large percentage, but because it's such a small population, the dollars aren't as large. The total required contribution for this plan is 40.2%, and we have a contribution sufficiency of 5.3%. But keep in mind the volatility, and it's really good to have a good size cushion for the State Patrol plan because of that. Slide 14 is our projections. So the solid lines in the various colors are if we wouldn't have passed the pension bill and would have just had a 10.3% return. So it shows that we would have seen improvement. You might recall last year we were heading downward in all of our programs. So we would have been flat with that 10.3% return and then subsequent 7.5% returns. Because of the additional reforms that were included in the bill as well as the contributions, all of our plans are now heading upward to 100% funding before the amortization period ends. So that is a good news story for those plans. The last plan that we administer for a defined benefit plan is on page 15, and that's our judges plan. They are 53.4% funded, and that looks really bad when you compare it to the others. And there's a few reasons why. So the judges plan wasn't pre-funded until 1992. So that means people who retired before 1992, when they retired, they just took the assets out of the program, moved it into something called the post fund that no longer exists, and then they would pay benefits out of that. So it was kind of a pay-as-you-go model. In 1992, they started pre-funding this program. So they were about 20-plus years behind everybody else in the pre-funding model. They've been making up ground ever since. So they have $201 million in assets and $176.2 million in unfunded liabilities. Again, like the State Patrol plan, a large retiree population relative to the active, although not as steep. And their average initial benefit is $5,663 a month. This is combined both by the retirement multiplier as well as they have a higher salary because they are judges, and so they have a higher high five. In 2013, this plan went through some significant benefit changes, and so new judges actually have a different formula than those hired prior to 2013. It's a lower benefit structure for newer judges. So the contributions are either paying 7% or 9%, depending on if they're pre-2013 or post-2013. The newer judges are paying a lower contribution rate. The employer contribution is 22.5%. The state funding, they do get a $6 million annual appropriation. So the total required contributions for this program are 42.4%, and they have a slight contribution sufficiency of 0.1%. So much, and that's even with the increased liabilities going to the 7.5% return. So if you look at page 16, that is the projections for judges before and after. So this looks different than the others. The before, they were actually on the best path relative to all of our other plans. They were heading to 100% within the amortization period. Because they took on the additional liabilities of the 7.5%, it dropped them down, and they don't quite get there in the amortization period. So that is kind of a different sort of story, but they had gone through some pretty big reforms in 2013. MSRS, we also administer the legislators' plan. This is a closed plan to in 1997, so any new legislators are now in our unclassified plan. And that the unclassified plan is a defined contribution plan that is available to it's primarily elected officials, department heads, commissioners, appointees. 3,200 members in there. We also administer the Minnesota Deferred Compensation Plan. Mr. Perry mentioned that. So that is voluntary a voluntary program for all public employees throughout the state. So it's the fourth or fifth largest plan, depending on the year, of this type in the country. So pretty significant number of assets. And then the healthcare savings plan is our newest plan. It was established in 2001 and allows public employees to save for healthcare expenses after they leave public service. So it's a benefit that it's tax-free going in, tax-free going out for reimbursement because it's entirely healthcare, and it was established by a governmental trust in 2001. So that is MSRS.
For PARA, the general plan, this is the largest plan in the state by number of members. We now are over 100,000 retired members each year getting a check every month, 150,000 active members. And although it's the largest by a number of members, it's not the largest in assets at $21.6 billion. The average initial benefit is $1,275 a month, but the median is actually quite a bit lower than that. So half of our members are getting $870 a month or less. The members themselves come from cities and counties and schools. Pretty much anyone in a school really who's not a teacher is roughly who would be participating in this plan. And it's about half the members are from cities and counties and townships, and half are school employees. The employee and employer contribution rate did not change as part of the 2018 omnibus bill. 6.5% for employees, 7.5% for employers. The next component is the MRF contributions. So this is just showing the current allocation. Commissioner Franz covered this quite thoroughly. So it's we think of it as $37 million fixed. We are not particularly concerned about the allocation. We're mostly concerned about the total and making sure that that total stays in place. So it's $37 million. It's a fixed contribution through the year 2031. When it's expressed as a percent of payroll, it's going to decline as the payroll increases. So with the current contribution rates, there is a contribution sufficiency of 1.5% after the 2031 expiration of the MRF contribution payments. That sufficiency is slightly less than 1%. So there is that margin there. This plan is on a good path going forward and expected to be fully funded in the year 2037. The police and fire plan includes full-time and certain part-time police officers, firefighters, and some paramedics. With over 11,000 active members, 10,700 retired members, only 1.1 active per retiree. Aaron talked a little bit about that. This is what makes a plan sensitive when that ratio isn't very high. Any changes that impact liabilities when converted into a payroll cost can provide some volatility on that cost. So the plan is 88.8% funded, expected to be fully funded in the year 2031. So it's on a fairly positive path. The contributions, I have a lot of asterisks here. So first off, the employee and the employer contributions, these did change as part of the omnibus bill. Up 1% increase for employees, phased in over 2 years, 1.5% for employers, phased in over 2 years. So these are the fully loaded, fully phased in numbers at 11.8 and 17.7. Then there were two other Minneapolis employer-related mergers. One was the Police Relief Association, and the other was the Fire Relief Association. And these both came in 2010, and there have been contributions made by the city of Minneapolis and those employers. And this is something that we are going to ask the commission to consider this year, changing from what's currently a variable contribution that could change from year to year to a fixed annual contribution. So these two are scheduled through the year 2031, and we'd like to see a little bit more certainty there. And then the final component is the state direct aid contributions, and this was mentioned earlier. There was an existing $9 million per year that was coming into the PARA Police and Fire, and then an additional amount from the recent change that's being phased in to be another $9 million a year Those go away when the plan reaches full funding. Again, this plan is projected to be fully funded in the year 2031. So the contribution sufficiency looks rather large, but when you consider the other components and only look at just the regularly scheduled employee and employer contributions after the others expire, the sufficiency is closer to 2.3%. And again, this is a plan that's subject to some volatility due to its makeup. And then on page 20, our correctional plan. This is a relatively newer plan. It's only been around about 20 years. So unlike some of the other plans, it has a pretty high ratio of actives to retirees. And it's really pretty well funded. It's approaching 100% funded. And the contribution is much simpler, no asterisks there. It's just 5.83% from the employees, 8.75% from the employers. The contributions from the employees and employers are going almost exclusively to cover the cost of benefit accruals. Not much is needed to help fully fund the plan because it's already nearly fully funded. So there's a slight contribution sufficiency. So there will be a little bit more progress on the funding, but it's already at a fairly high funded level. So this is a good model of where we want our other plans to be. I would also add, I mentioned earlier about the approach for the COLAs. The retirees in this plan, as long as this plan stays above a certain funding threshold, their cost of living adjustment is 100% of inflation with a 2.5% cap. So since it's a well-funded plan, it's in a position to afford that better protection for the retirees, better inflation protection. So page 21 is showing the projections before and after the law change. Note the general plan, a pretty high path, high growth path, as well as with the police and fire. Correctional plan is noted before. It's already close to 100%, and thus it's really projected to stay around there. All these lines here are shown prior to the 10.2% fiscal year 18 return. So they're actually a little bit better than what this plan, what these lines currently show. So again, the full funding dates, 2025 for the correctional plan, 2031 for police and fire, 2037 for the general plan. And then on page 22 are the other plans that PARA administers. The statewide volunteer firefighter plan that has over 4,000 individual members, roughly 160 different fire departments from this around the state. Close to $90 million in assets, and then a defined contribution plan for local elected officials, 7,700 members, $70 million in assets. And then just from really a strictly administrative purpose, PARA does essentially the accounting for 23 different entities that have other post-employment benefits, and then two participants who participate in the recently established long-term investment account.
Madam Chair, I'll pick up on the teacher side of the equation. On slide 23 is the overview for TRA. And the TRA is the plan for all the public and charter school educators in the state, except for those in St. Paul. Jill will cover those later. We also have included in our membership some of the faculty of the Minnesota State System. When those faculty members are first hired, they have a choice to pick either TRA or an IRAP program. They have another choice at 10-year time, but we do have a small number of Minnesota State faculty. We're predominantly a fund of public and charter school educators. That's the classroom teachers, the superintendents, the counselors, the nurses, anybody. Roughly, the way to think of it is anyone with a teaching license is in TRA, and those without a license are in the PERA. It's not as simple as all that, but that's kind of a simple way to think about it. With a bill passing and with a good investment year, we reached 78% funding at June 30, 2018, with $22 billion in assets and a $6.3 billion unfunded liability. Almost 200,000 members, 82,000 active, 66,000 retired, deferred are the people who have an account and they're not paying in anymore and they're not collecting a benefit. They're basically on hold. They're just not of age yet, or it could be other reasons why they're not receiving a benefit, but about 49,000 of those people. An average initial benefit of $2,175 for the retirees in our plan. On the right side of that page, the employee contribution, before the bill was passed, the employee and the employer rates were the same at 7.5%. So the employee rate is going up to 7.75%. The employer rate, the rate itself, will be 8.75%, and that will eventually happen 5 years from now. They've already started to ratchet up. Those rates are phasing in over time. But the 8.95% comes in from a little bit more of the – that's the actual percentage of covered payroll that goes along with the 8.75% that we're getting from all the employers. And then the school district of Minneapolis pays, I think it's an extra 3.84%. That's related to the merger of the Minneapolis Teacher Fund. So the blend of those 8.75 and the additional 3.84 from the Minneapolis school district gives us the 8.95% employer. We get some state funding. I'll cover that a little bit more on the next slide, but 0.69% comes in from the state. So the number you see there, 17.18, Commissioner Franz was talking about the annual recovered, the annual required contribution rate, or the ARC. That's the ARC for the TRA at June 30, 2018, 17.18%. And the total is a little bit higher than that coming in, so we have a surplus of 0.21%. That ARC is recalculated every year by the actuaries, kind of takes into account any fluctuation in assets, asset values. Unfunded liabilities will increase or diminish based on investment returns. So the ARC is recalculated every year to come up with a new number based on that experience. The next slide is a little bit about the annual direct funding that we receive from the state. And these primarily come about because of the mergers that have occurred in the past few years. In 2006, the Minneapolis Teacher Pension Plan was merged with TRA, and that was a complex merger with a lot of pieces to it. There's direct state aid of $12.9 million that comes in. There's a state match, additional state funding, that matches the Minneapolis City and the Minneapolis School District. Each of those two entities pays $1,250,000. So the state matches that total of $2.5 million. And then on top of that, the City of Minneapolis and the school district pay another $1 million as a result of the merger that occurred. So that is a total of $15.5 million roughly per year that comes in as a result of that merger. And then in 2015, the Duluth Teacher Plan merged in with the TRA, and that only is that only contains state financing. There's various reasons why that occurred the way that happened, but $14.4 million roughly comes in from the state to fund the unfunded liability that the TRA took on as a result of that merger. There's something called amortization state aid that is left over from the Minneapolis fund that was in existence prior to the merger. It was just additional state aid that the state was paying to amortize the unfunded liability. Those amortization aids were created many years ago and had different iterations of them. But when the merger occurred, we continued to get that amortization state aid on behalf of the Minneapolis school district or pension fund that was receiving it at that time. So in total from the state of Minnesota, $31.1 million per year coming in direct state aid. The next slide, 25, is the funding that was contained in the 2018 pension bill. And the annual appropriations that will be made to the Department of Education are there to cover the higher employer contribution rates that are being phased in. So you can see the phase-in actually started this year. The year that we're in, fiscal 19, was the first step of the phase-in, and that rate will continue to increase to 8.75% by the year fiscal 24. And the resulting increasing obligation behind that rate increase is that second row of information. So in fiscal 19, $8.9 million was the total sum of money that's associated with the percentage increase. And you can see how that ratchets up to $71 million per year by the year fiscal 24. So those are appropriations going to the Department of Education, who will allocate those dollars to the school districts based on their covered payroll, the payroll of each school district. So it's a very precise calculation. It gets the district exactly or most precisely what they need. It's based on the payroll and the increasing rate of payroll that is associated with the employer contribution. So it's the payroll and the rate increase that's tied to each district. So it's a pretty precise calculation and a very good, fair way to do that. And that appropriation, as I said, goes to the Department of Education through a pension adjustment in the school aid formula. The next slide is a result of the pension bill and, again, a good investment year last year kind of contributed to an improving picture. But without the bill, we were heading towards 52% funded, not a good path to be on. We were sitting at 70%, and it's not really looking at pension financing. It's not so much, or it's not only where you are today, but in which direction you are heading. And being 70% funded isn't a disaster. There are some funds around the country you probably hear about, read about, that are 30 or 40% funded and heading in the wrong direction. So we were 70%, not happy just to sit at 70, but heading in a very bad direction. The bill passed. We had a good year, so we jumped to 78 to be 78% funded and projected to be overfunded within a 30-year period. So a very significant improvement for the teacher plan.
Great, good. Thank you. We'll turn to St. Paul Teachers on page 27. Before I start that, though, I do feel like I need to thank Mr. Anderson. Hopefully you noticed we always call on him to talk about mortality. Nobody does death, cancer, and diabetes like he does. You can see why he's the life of every pension party that we throw. So on to St. Paul. We've been around since 1909, serving the single purpose of helping St. Paul teachers retire. We have about 12,000 members, and we have a funded number here that may not seem so exciting to many of you, and I understand that, but it actually is, because when we factor in historic underfunding and then taking on very significant liabilities that have been discussed here in great detail, coming down on the investment return assumption and mortality, without this bill, our funding should have crashed into the 50s. And without the funding, as we looked over a long period of time, similar to Mr. Stoffel's comment, without this, we would have stagnated in the mid-50s in perpetuity. But as I'll talk about a little more later, while we're at roughly 64% now, the more important piece of this is the trajectory. Not only does this put us on a path to full funding, but it gets us to full funding a decade earlier than our amortization period. And particularly when you're dealing with a mature fund like ours, that's critically important. We need to get this fund into the 80s and into a well-funded status as quickly as possible. And this bill did exactly that. It's been mentioned, our retirees, I'm very grateful to them. They did sacrifice their COLA for 2 years. And the return was really a very generous allocation to this fund. So in terms of an employer contribution increase, we increased from 6.5% to 9%. And as I'll show on the next slide, that is phased in over a number of years. And as well, we received an additional $5 million of direct funding. I won't belabor this, but on the next page, it just goes through what this funding looks like over the six-year period. And like TRA, in the boxes, the six-year increase to the employer contribution, the mechanism for that is state funding through the education appropriation. So again, that with the $5 million allows us to go to fully funded 10 years prior to our amortization period. I'd be happy to answer any questions. I think in summary for all of us, again, we just want to say thank you, express our gratitude. It was a tremendous effort by all involved, producing an outstanding outcome, not only for over 500,000 retirees in Minnesota, but to all the citizens of the state who benefit from an improved bond rating. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Rosen, I'm sorry.
It's all right. Madam Chair, I'd just like to say, number one, that this the work that we accomplished last year was historic, absolutely. Not only the unanimous vote, but also that you have a team of fund managers up there that are collaborating together. I didn't realize how unusual that is until you go into other states, and I've had the opportunity to talk about this bill in some other settings. They do not get along in other states. So I just, you know, we may take this for granted, but this is highly unusual. So our A team is has stepped up, and I really do appreciate that. So thank you. But I do have a question too. If somebody else has a question, I'll find where I'm at.
Okay. Do you have the average age of, or at what age is most of your people that are retired?
I can start that off. For St. Paul, our average, and this has increased over the last decade, you've seen it really move up, our average retirement age is 64 now. And when we talk to people about that, that's attributable to a combination of factors, it seems. First of all, over time, increasing the cost of retiring earlier, as you've heard mentioned, making that more actuarially equivalent. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, the cost of health care seems to be a major driver of that decision.
Okay. And is that the health care for the individual or the health care for the spouse?
Both, actually.
Okay. Mr. Stoffel?
Madam Chair, yes, if the question is about the average retirement age these days, it's around 62, 63. It's not quite as high as 64, but 62, 63. Okay. 10 years ago, 15 years ago, that number was 57. So it's been ratcheting up pretty rapidly, pretty significantly over time due to, again, cost of health care. The economic crisis that occurred slashed 403B balances and 401K balances. People tend to stay put and not retire into a horrific recession and economic condition like that. Also, teachers sometimes retire and go and find other employment at times after retirement. Those opportunities kind of shrivel up in a bad economy, too. So lots of reasons why people are tending to, and just the mortality, as number two on the list of best mortality in the nation. Living longer, people think, well, maybe work longer, too. So a lot of factors.
Okay. Mr. Anderson?
Madam Chair, I believe it's age 64 for our general plan, and I'm not sure what it is for our public safety plans and correctional.
Okay.
For the MSRS general plan, it's between 64 and 65. It's actually getting closer to 65. I think it's primarily because of health care, and people need the Medicare. They need to have the Medicare plus the supplement in order to afford their health care.
Okay. And what's your oldest retiree?
So our oldest retiree just passed away, and I think it was a she, I believe, and she was 111.
I have a long way to go.
You do, yes.
Woo! Mm-hmm. At least. Ms. Schertz?
I believe ours was 104.
Okay.
Madam Chair, 106 for para.
Uh-huh. Oh. Madam Chair, 113 for TRA, and we have over 120 people in the over 100 years of age club.
Wow. Holy cow. Do they meet? Sarah Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I found my question. This is to Mr. Anderson. Mr. Anderson, you mentioned something about changes that need to happen for the police and fire plan overview on page 19. We're at the variable contribution, and we perhaps need to look at a fixed contribution. Can you explain that just a little bit more, please?
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen. Yes, on page 19, the Minneapolis Police Relief Association and the Minneapolis Fire Relief Association both merged into PARA at the same time as December 30th, 2011. And in the statutes at that time was a direction that if the investment return assumption changes, the annual contribution amount is redetermined. So there was an initial estimate. There was a redetermination in 2015. Then there's another redetermination here with the investment return change that occurred. But there's just some question about what that does and the potential for that change going forward. So right now, there's uncertainty in what that contribution may be going forward, that if the investment return assumption changes anytime between now and 2031, there's a change in amount. And the city of Minneapolis desires more certainty in that amount so that there's not great fluctuation. That's something that our board has reviewed, and we do want to bring to the commission that we believe that we have a fair approach that would allow them to have a fixed contribution. It would provide us some certainty, and it would provide the remainder members of the fund some kind of form of compensation for taking on that risk. So that's ultimately the goal, is to turn a variable and uncertain into a certain amount.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned the Minneapolis fund, that contributions stop in 2031. So that just funded after that with normal contributions, or maybe a little rationale on how that worked, because I wasn't here when it was done. I'm just curious how that all puts together.
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative Vogel, I want to take every opportunity I can to make a distinction between the MRF merger for the general plan and the mergers for the Police Relief Association, right, yep, and Fire Relief Association.
This was MRF.
So with MRF, the amortization period was set at 2031 initially when the merger occurred in 2010. I suspect that was the same as the existing amortization period for the remainder of the fund. So now we think of the amortization periods this past year were reset to 2048, but at that time, the amortization period, target amortization period for the general fund was 2031. So I believe that the MRF contribution was set up to first determine the unfunded liability amount, then determine the funding date, the target date of 2031, and determine the appropriate contribution during that period.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So then, I'm not as good at this stuff as you are, but when we extended our amortization out, should we have also, in theory, I don't want to put you on the spot, and if you don't want to answer, I understand, but in theory, would we have then looked at extending this amortization period out as well, or was that fully amortized in 2031 so that you see where my question? And again, I'm not trying to put you on the spot. I'm just trying to understand what happened here.
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative Vogel, so there was an initial contribution amount for an initial amortization period, and that amount was deemed to be fixed as a total of $37 million. If there were consideration of extending the amortization period for that, it would change the amortization amount. But that isn't something that was ever approached with us.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay.
So I'm gathering then that it was basically figured out back when it happened in 2010 to 2031, and indeed when it quits at 2031, there wouldn't be any need for any more contribution to make it work because it was fully worked out when it was done. If that wasn't too confusing of a question, I'm even confusing myself. But
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative Vogel, I think I do understand the question. I just want to make a clarification. So MRF merged in 2010 and was administered on kind of a standalone basis until 2015. And then in 2015, it was considered fully merged in. I think the threshold was that when the entire fund reached 80% funded, MRF would be considered fully phased in, fully merged in. And then at that time in 2015, the unfunded liability related to MRF was determined. And based on the assumptions at that time, that unfunded liability is set to be paid in fixed contributions over 2031, and then they cease. So it's the fixed contributions are there for a fixed amount and a fixed period of time, and then they would stop, and there is no further recalculation after that point.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, for indulging me. I know it's late at night, and I probably shouldn't have gone there in the first place because I'm now confusing myself with this whole thing, and maybe we can catch up sometime offline because... Just, again,
Madam
trying
Chair.
To understand. Thank you.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, just, you know, maybe plain language, it means at that point you have enough money to meet all your obligations. So for MRF, so you don't need any more money from the state. So anybody who's still retired, there's money in the fund to pay their retirement until they die.
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, yes, that's okay. The theory is that it would fully, it's what's needed to fully fund the, right. The obligation.
Right.
And people can live on.
And they can continue to live on, yes.
All right. Any further questions? Thank you so much for this update.
Thank you.
It was good to hear. And members, we did an okay job. We can be glad of this. Is there anyone in the audience that wants to address this meeting? Anything that was said tonight or last week that you've been thinking about and you can't sleep and so you get up and say, I wish I would have been able to talk to the Pension Commission. All right. This meeting will adjourn until March 12th at our next meeting at 5:10. Is that an acceptable number? Okay. I compromised from 5 o'clock. And I got 3 senators here by 5:10, so it's all right. Well, two and then one little late one. So if I say 5...
Say 4:30.
All right. I'll take that advice. This meeting is adjourned. Thank you for coming.